B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. Your humble host is going to take a quick break. A little more summertime fun before it all goes away. My next podcast will be coming your way on Wednesday, August 21st. Now, Mitch McConnell is listening to the NRA, and the Senate will not be called back into session. It will enjoy its month-long summer recess. And when they return, McConnell is betting that people will have moved on from the latest round of mass shootings, and that the pressure to do something will probably have subsided. But I want to put forward here and endorse a proposal coming from the mayor of San Jose, California, Sam Liccardo. His city lost two of the three people who were killed at the massacre at the Gilroy Garlic Festival just a couple of weeks ago. And Sam Liccardo believes that if gun owners are required to carry hefty liability insurance beyond their homeowners' policies, that in essence, the insurance companies will regulate gun ownership in ways that Congress and state legislatures are not willing to even consider. Now, this is something that has appealed to me for a long time, because I support most of the reasonable gun control legislative proposals that have been put forward, background checks and, all of those other issues. A ban on so-called assault weapons. But because we have so many guns in circulation, we cannot, in my view, there isn't the political will to buy back guns, to take guns away from people. And I think that the economic incentives that insurance companies will put in front of gun owners, just like they do automobile drivers, all right? You know, when they first introduced driver's ed, you could get a discount. You get a discount if you haven't had an accident for a while. And the primary coverage that every driver is required to carry is liability insurance. And I know that liability insurance is not going to keep a deranged individual from going out and shooting a bunch of people. It's not a rational act, and rational considerations don't enter into their minds. But this could help reduce the number of gun deaths that occur in homes. It is friendly fire and suicide, after all, that are the biggest statistical groups of gun deaths in this country. When I say friendly fire, it means that the person who was shot knew the person who shot them. So I'd like you to think about this, and if you're so inclined, promote the idea with your own elected representatives. Now, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is trying to keep the issue alive, and he is going to demand of President Trump that he withdraw his request for $5 billion in border wall funding and redirect the money toward programs that aim to reduce gun violence and white supremacist extremism. Schumer said, "The dual scourges of gun violence and violent white supremacist extremism in this country are a national security threat, plain and simple, and it's time the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress started treating them as such." Now, this is a nice try, Chuckles. But I think it's a bad idea to give Trump the idea that Congress is willing to move money from one purpose to another. After all, the Supreme Court, in its most ridiculous decision, and one that I think will have long-term negative impacts, it upheld the president's plan on a technicality to divert Defense Department budgeted money by Congress to construction of a portion of wall along the southern border. So I don't like the idea of Schumer giving Trump other ideas of where he could find money for a wall. because clearly this proposal is going absolutely nowhere. Over in Hong Kong, the second day in a row, the Kai Tak Airport is shut down by protesters. We have confirmation that flights from Hong Kong to San Francisco were canceled, and outbound flights to Hong Kong from SFO are also being canceled. Riot police armed with pepper spray and batons clashed with protesters late on Tuesday at Hong Kong's airport. And you know, Tuesday is tomorrow over there. Or actually, Tuesday has already happened, and I'm in the middle of Tuesday here in the United States right now. Police intervened after a frenzied mob of protesters seized a man claiming he was an undercover Chinese police officer, and they blocked paramedics from transporting him for hours after he lost consciousness. They also seized a man who was identified as a reporter for the Global Times, the Chinese Communist Party-run newspaper. So the tactics are escalating. And while I support the protesters, there are incidents of violence that will only provide excuses for Beijing to crack down in a very bloody way. And I fear that's what we're going to see. So one anecdote, an officer was overwhelmed, his baton taken by protesters who beat him with it. The group retreated only after the officer appeared to pull his gun from a holster. Then a second man was apprehended by protesters bound to a luggage cart with cable ties, and that was the reporter for the Global Times. Now, I certainly understand the angst that they feel and the oppression and suppression that is part of their daily lives. And shifting from the voice of the Washington Post to the voice of the New York Times, the protesters at the airport Tuesday were particularly angered by the tactics used by police against demonstrators on Sunday, including firing tear gas into a train station and sending officers into crowds dressed as demonstrators to make arrests. With tensions running high at the airport late Tuesday, the demonstrators surrounded and attacked a man they accused of being a mainland police officer impersonating a protester. So that's their version of the same event that I cited a moment ago. Meanwhile, the benevolent patriarch, our generous, stable genius, the man whose every tweet we hang on, Trump has just arbitrarily decided that the tariffs that he threatened to impose on Chinese imports on September 1st, many will be delayed until December 15th. Some will never take effect. Of course, that is all subject to change. And he did it because he wants us to have a Merry Christmas. Quote, we're doing this for the Christmas season, just in case some of the tariffs would have an impact on U.S. consumers. And the idea is that we buy all this stuff in the fourth quarter. And Trump appears to have some sensitivity that the tariffs that he said China is paying, but we know consumers here in the United States are paying, could dampen consumer behavior and confidence. So, here's the list. Consumer electronics, video game consoles, some toys, computer monitors, some footwear, clothing items were among the trade representative's office list of those that will not be hit with tariffs until retailers have time to stockpile what they need for their busiest time of year. Now, the assumption by Trump here is that the Chinese will take no other action. And I don't think that's a good bet. Because this back and forth, these arbitrary and capricious decisions that Trump makes and then changes his mind on, I don't think there's anything that galls the Chinese more than that kind of inconsistency and unpredictability. And last week, they got unpredictable for a day as they let the currency, the yuan, float for a little while, and then they stopped. And what if they decided to embargo a bunch of iPhones? They say, well, you know, we need to inspect them, and we might release them after Christmas sometime. So this kind of willy-nilly tit-for-tat emotionally driven action, it's counterproductive for all of us. There's just no way around that. So the Jeffrey Epstein story is going to be dominating the news cycles for a while. The FBI went to St. James, Little St. James Island in the Virgin Islands, and searched his mansion there. We also are learning that that reference that I passed along to you yesterday from our listener John in Sacramento, which was screenshots of 4chan with reports that appeared to come from somebody inside the Metropolitan Correctional Center or somebody who may have been involved in the attempt to resuscitate Epstein. Allegedly and reportedly, right? So 40 minutes before ABC News first reported Epstein's death on Twitter, someone posted still unverified details on 4chan, the anonymous message board popular with far-right trolls and white nationalists. And I read this to you yesterday. Don't ask me how I know, but Epstein died an hour ago from hanging, cardiac arrest. Screencapped this, a reference to posting it at 4chan. And that was precisely 38 minutes before the first public report that came from ABC News. And after publishing the post, other 4chan users egged on the author, who posted five or six times, including a detailed breakdown of the procedures allegedly used to resuscitate Epstein, or to attempt, which suggests the poster may have been a first responder, a medical worker, or somehow privy to details about efforts to revive after the alleged suicide. Fire Department of New York, the department will review this incident. Also, the Bureau of Prisons has suspended the or reassigned the guards who were on duty that night, and I believe they are disciplining one of the managers there. So, you know, this is all curious. It feeds the speculation. It feeds the so-called conspiracy theories. And as I explained to you yesterday, these are ways of dismissing and diminishing honest skepticism and rational rejection of bullshit. But we're all supposed to just, you know, curl up and say, oh, don't call me a conspiracy theorist, please. So James B. Stewart, who's a superstar reporter at the New York Times, had an interview with Epstein just about a year ago. It was on August 16th of last year. And he went to visit Epstein at his huge mansion in Manhattan. Now released from the rules of the interview, which was that Epstein could only be quoted on background, meaning his name could not be used. Stewart reports that Epstein knew an astonishing number of rich, powerful, and famous people, had photos to prove it. He also claimed to know a great deal about these people, some of it potentially damaging, including details about their supposed sexual proclivities and recreational drug use. And that fits with the idea that he used sexual blackmail. We know that he was running a very small investment operation. Kind of like Bernie Madoff, it could have been all fake. And it does seem likely that his major client, Les Wexner, gave Epstein complete control over his fortune in ways that can't be explained unless Wexner was somehow compromised. Epstein made no secret of his own scandalous past, acknowledged to Stewart that he was a pariah in polite society, but he seemed unapologetic. This was Stewart's first encounter with Epstein, and he went to ask him about a rumor that Epstein had been advising Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla. And Musk and Tesla deny that they ever talked to Epstein or got his advice. But he told Stewart, Epstein did, that you know, he couldn't talk much about his work for Musk and for Tesla, and that they would deny it if Stewart asked them, which in fact they did. He bragged about a picture with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. He displayed pictures of Bill Clinton and Woody Allen, actually pointed them out to Stewart as they walked through this massive mansion. He said that Epstein was more at ease discussing his interest in young women. He said criminalizing sex with teenage girls was a cultural aberration, and that at times in history is perfectly acceptable. He said he'd witnessed prominent tech figures in Silicon Valley taking drugs and arranging for sex, and he stressed that he never drank or used drugs of any kind. And then a week later, Epstein called Stewart and asked him if he'd like to have dinner with Woody Allen and Epstein. Stewart declined. He was too busy. Kevin Gostola gathers more data from the defamation lawsuit that one of the accusers of Epstein, we now know her name, Virginia Jeffrey, she said that she was recruited at age 15, forced into sexual service to Epstein, and passed along to his friends. Jeffrey implicates former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, former U.S. Senator and envoy George Mitchell, Hyatt Hotels heir Tom Pritzker, hedge fund manager Glenn Dubin, MIT professor Marvin Minsky, Alan Dershowitz, Prince Andrew, and another unnamed prince. Maybe that's MBS. Now, this drew strenuous denials from people like Bill Richardson, and I know him a little bit. I've interviewed him, and I visited him once when he was the governor of New Mexico. He seems smarter than a person who would get caught up in sexual blackmail. But he's also, you know, a guy with a big ego, and a large man who probably didn't get a lot of groupie offers. So these are very hard to evaluate. And Kevin Gostola at Shadowproof notes that there are a lot of people eager to blame the Russians for killing Epstein, starting with Joe Scarborough. He just said, here it is. A guy who had information that would have destroyed rich and powerful men's lives ends up dead in his jail cell. How predictably Russian. NBC News noted that the Kremlin-funded media outlet RT was leading its English-language website with stories about conspiracy theories related to Epstein's death. And Gostola points out, so was every other media outlet. Alec Baldwin, the guy who loves to impersonate Trump on Saturday Night Live, he declared the Russians killed Epstein. They're in charge of everything now. And George Takei speculated on Twitter, this sounds like something that would happen in Russia, no? Well, that's a real virulent virus we just haven't been able to stamp out. Washington Post has an interesting lengthy piece that I've linked to in the show file for today's podcast that shows the real acrimonious fighters in this dispute. Because super lawyer David Boies, whose most favorable credit is that he teamed up with former Solicitor General Olson, and they jointly took on the case that overturned Proposition 8 here in California, which had banned gay marriage after it had been made legal. That is the high point for David Boies. More recently, he was embarrassed after the New York Times discovered that he was representing the Times and Harvey Weinstein as the Times was investigating Weinstein. And there are other dark chapters in David Boies' history. So his big opponent right now is Alan Dershowitz. And I've met and interviewed Dershowitz several times, and I find him really detestable. But I can't prove that he had sex with Virginia Jeffrey. She says he did. He strenuously denies it by calling her a liar. This leads to defamation suits, with David Boies taking the unusual move to issue a declaration to the court where he slams Dershowitz. He says, after extensive consideration, everything Dershowitz told and showed me, I ultimately concluded that his denials were not credible. So it goes back and forth. And at one point, there was an attempt at a truce between Dershowitz and Boies. They met and talked, and then they resumed suing each other and calling each other names. So it's an interesting piece. I think that it helps define the two litigants, combatants, who will preside over what remains of the viable cases arising from Jeffrey Epstein's. I'm at a loss for words. I wanted to call it his life or his ugly legacy. Maybe that's the best way to put it. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Suzanne Bowen, Faith Peoples, Carl Howard, Jim Garrison. They each kick in $5 to $20 a month. And you can do it too. It's easy. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com. Find the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page. It's easy. You can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you choose the $50 annual subscription, I've got a bonus book for you, Trump on the Couch by Dr. Justin A. Frank, or 2100, A Dystopian Utopia, the blueprint for surviving climate change. I've got a fresh interview for my subscribers today. We'll be releasing my conversation with David Daley, which was posted at Who, What, Why a couple of weeks ago. David Daley wrote the book on gerrymandering, or do you say Gary? The guy who gerrymandering is named for pronounced his name Gary. It gets a little messy. But there were two critical Supreme Court decisions at the end of the last term regarding redistricting, highly partisan redistricting, and we connect that to the Trump administration's desperate efforts to get a census question about citizenship into the 2020 census. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with author and journalist David Daley.
What happened over the course of this last decade is Republicans set about using the gerrymandering, this ancient political term of politicians drawing their own lines to lock themselves in advantages and to disadvantage the other side. And they did so with the best technology and the most precise voter data ever available, so that they were able to draw gerrymanders in 2011, the last time we went through this process, that were fundamentally different and more enduring than any other time in our nation's history. And we have seen the impact of this on our politics, both nationally and in all of these states that were so heavily gerrymandered over the course of this decade. Democrats have not been able to win a chamber back in the state legislatures in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, or Michigan this entire decade under these maps, even in years in which they win hundreds of thousands of more votes. It's not enough. And the trials in all of these states have laid out quite clearly the intent behind how this happened and the specifics of the precise mathematical formulas and the surgical way that these map makers went about crafting these lines in order to ensure that they would be a firewall against a majority of voters. And those firewalls have held this entire decade. We just so needed the Supreme Court to stand up here and say, we can't perhaps draw every map ourselves. We're not interested in taking on that responsibility. But when partisans go so far as to entrench minority rule for a decade, maybe longer, that is anti-American, it's anti-small-d democratic, and we're not going to allow it to happen.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with David Daley. A lot of important information and good commentary on this pair of really bad decisions by the Robert Supreme Court. Over at Consortium News today, my friend Ray McGovern has an update on what he refers to as the Seth Rich controversy. And he says federal judges are now demanding proof that Russia hacked into the DNC in the first place And as you know, this has been the basis of my skepticism of Mueller and Russiagate from the start. And the Mueller report provides no new evidence or even alludes to new evidence that the DNC was hacked by Russian intelligence agents, as Mueller asserted in an indictment. McGovern repeats what we know, which is that Bill Binney and the VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, conducted some very serious tests, and they came up with some evidence that it was impossible to hack the DNC at the speeds that were achieved. It must have been a leak. And that brings us to Seth Rich. And McGovern, who's got a wicked sense of humor, says simply letting the name Seth Rich pass your lips can condemn you to the leper colony built by the Washington establishment for conspiracy theorists. The term regularly applied to someone determined to seek tangible evidence and who is open to alternatives to Russia did it. As you know, Seth Rich was a young DNC employee murdered on the street in Washington on July 10th of 2016. And McGovern writes, many, including me, suspect that Rich played some role in the leaking of DNC emails to WikiLeaks. There is considerable circumstantial evidence that this may have been the case. But those who voice such suspicions are ipso facto branded conspiracy theorists. Then he points to the court case where Ed Butowski has sued NPR and others for defaming him. And on August 7th, NPR suffered a setback when U.S. District Court Judge Amos Mazant affirmed a lower court decision to allow Butowski's defamation lawsuit to proceed. The judge ruled that NPR has stated as, quote, verifiable statements of fact, quote, information that could not be verified, if had been in effect accused of being engaged in wrongdoing without persuasive sourcing language. NPR and others in similar positions are scurrying around for allies. The day after the judge issued that decision, NPR enlisted from discredited Yahoo News pundit Michael Isikoff, who with author David Korn wrote the fiction posing as fact Russian Roulette. NPR gave Isikoff 37 minutes on fresh air to spin his yarn about how the Seth Rich story got started, and of course they blame the Russians. Then Joe Lauria interviewed Isikoff a few weeks ago on Consortium News Live. Isikoff admitted he never saw a classified Russian intelligence document, reportedly indicating that 3 days after Rich's murder, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service planted a story about Rich having been the leaker and was killed and then killed for it. This Russian intelligence bulletin, as if Isikoff called it, was supposedly placed on a bizarre website that Isikoff admitted was an unlikely place for Russia to spread disinformation. And he acknowledged that he only took the word of a former prosecutor in the Rich case about the existence of this classified Russian document. Again, he's never seen it. Continuing with McGovern's narrative here, Butowski's libel lawsuit can now proceed to discovery, which will include demands for documents and depositions, which are likely to shed light on whatever role Rich may have played. Then there comes the recent interview by Joe Lauria and Elizabeth Voss on CN Live with Kim.com, the, shall we say, unusual man from New Zealand who changed his name, as you know, to .com. But he says he had conversations with Seth Rich and that there also may be conversations that Rich had with Julian Assange. .com says he put Rich in touch with a middleman to transfer the DNC files to WikiLeaks. So there is some evidence. There is some information. Compare that to Mueller, who offers us no evidence, and a lot of confusing information. Iran is tipping that there may be a deal soon to release the oil tanker called the Grace One, which was seized by Gibraltar authorities on the 4th of July, and it is believed that the ship was in international waters at the time. The British accused Iran of planning to send that oil to Syria in violation of an embargo, and this could lead to a reduction in the tensions in the Persian Gulf area. Yesterday, I didn't have time for this, but Business Insider has a report which I found quite problematic. They cite a report from the Pentagon Inspector General that the Islamic State is again growing in power in Syria and Iraq with approximately 14,000 to 18,000 militants. The report said that Trump's decision to rapidly draw down troops in Syria and pull diplomatic staff from Iraq increased instability and allowed the militants to regroup. Now, I call bullshit. And I'll even up the ante, neocon bullshit. We are told that there are only, at the peak, 2,000 American troops in Syria. Trump balked or was forced to water down his plan to withdraw them all. As far as we know, there's somewhere between 12 and 1,500 American troops there. And the idea that they have had any central role in the expansion or the ending of the conflict in Syria is just unbelievable. And this reminds me of the way the neocons blamed Obama for executing George W. Bush's exit plan from Iraq, despite desperate efforts on the part of Obama and Biden and national security people to extend the occupation of Iraq. This is just rearview mirror politics. And it appears to be coming from that guy, Brett McGurk, the former special presidential envoy to Syria under Bush, Obama, and Trump. That is my guess. I want to recommend a piece by Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, that was published August 12th at the American Conservative. He takes up the defense of one Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, who is running for president. He recounts comments that she made in recent debates, that she joined the military after 9/11. She felt lied to when she got to Iraq and realized that regime change war was not what she had signed up for. She has said, "Every single day I saw the high costs of war." And so Ritter notes that she's been honest about the way the Obama administration began funneling weapons and money through Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and others into Syria to support indirectly groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. If you or I gave money, weapons, or support to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, we would be thrown in jail. So I encourage you to read it, particularly if you find it difficult to respond to people who call her an apologist for Assad. Now, it's also noted in Scott Ritter's piece that my old friend Mike Gravel, the former senator from Alaska, who left the presidential race last week, has endorsed Tulsi Gabbard. But thanks to our friend John Zwiebel in Hawaii, he received messages of endorsement by Mike Gravel within minutes of each other, one that was rich in support for Tulsi Gabbard, and the other that was gushing in support for Bernie Sanders. So I guess Mike hasn't quite made up his mind on which candidate he will ultimately be supporting. And finally, I want to recommend a piece from August 12th in The Guardian under the byline of Tyler Bellstrom, who is a former policy fellow at the U.S. House of Representatives and a project manager at Progressive Talent Pipeline. I don't know much about that. Anyway, Tyler here does a pretty good job of looking at the hawks and doves among the Democratic presidential candidates. He defines liberal internationalist hawks, Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris, Obama redux, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and progressives, Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren. And he gives a paragraph on each of them, which I found to be fairly accurate. So check it out if you're interested. And thank you for joining me again today for my news and comment podcast. As always, you're free to share it all over the dang place with absolutely anyone, including people who don't agree with me. And you too. I'll return a week from tomorrow. That's August 21st. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.